It's finally here. After the multi-million pound opening, it's the multi-billion pound London Olympics. And the first glitch, when the North Korean women's football team saw red, or didn't, and threatened not to play when the South Korean flag was mistakenly shown rather than theirs. Spot the difference, and no prizes for identification. The Olympics are meant to imbue a feel-good factor, but it will take more than that, as the latest figures show that the UK is in a deepening double-dip recession. The work experience Chancellor George Osborne is out of his depth as we head for a longer lasting depression than in the 1930s. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney was in town to schmooze with the politicians in a grip and grin tour, or gag and grimace, more like. And how do you define a civil war? Well, what's happening in Syria is probably the answer. Will the Assad government survive? And even if it falls, what will change? My studio guest, a real expert, will be providing some answers, because this is the real deal. Welcome to The Real Deal on Press TV, still the voice of the voiceless. I'm George Galloway, and every week I'm in London bringing you the news and views you just won't get in the corporate media. Shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, as always. But if you wanted to fire back at me, you could, at least by email, at the address showing on the screen. Now, you can't move in London for tourists coming and going to the Olympics in East London. Special lanes on the roads, the Zil lanes, named after the exclusive lanes for the Politburo in Soviet times, are speeding athletes and officials, oh so many officials, to and fro, while the rest of the traffic descends into something approaching gridlock. The underground system is bulging at the seams. The army has been drafted in to bolster security. Over 17,000 soldiers on the streets, ground-to-air missiles on the roofs, and the public purse is almost empty. But hey, it's a game. The authorities are boasting that the games came in on budget, but only after they revised the budget upwards many times. It's now more than five times the cost that we were told it was going to be. Some of the events are in different parts of the country, and on Wednesday, the first diplomatic blunder occurred at Hampden Park in Scotland, when the South Korean flag, rather than the North Korean flag, was shown. That's the South's flag being shown on the left of the screen. The correct flag was then shown, but the North Korean women's football team then refused to play. It took an hour to persuade them to kick off. It can only get worse. And that's the news on the British economy too. We're in a worsening recession with no end in sight. The economy is now smaller than it was when the Tory Lib Dem coalition came to power in 2010. Step forward, the author of it. He's George Osborne, as he likes to be called, although the British Chancellor of the Exchequer was actually christened Gideon Osborne. He probably changed his name at his posh school, Eton. But he clearly wasn't paying attention when they did arithmetic, witnessed by the mess he's been making of the economy. This austerity regime isn't working, as the figures show, and as just about every sentient person in the country is saying, even his allies and funders in big business. The Bank of England is going to print more notes, probably up to £500 billion more, in an effort to stimulate growth. But Osborne, the work experience Chancellor, just doesn't get it. We're on the way to becoming a banana republic, but without the climate or the fruit. The country needs infrastructure projects to get people back to work and spending. Eventually, he will have to recognise this, or his successor will, perhaps more likely. The grisly Mitt Romney was on the grab in London during the week, hosting a dinner where really rich folks paid up to $75,000 a head for the rubber chicken, and a chance to bounce a question or two off the wooden Republican contender for president. Executives at Barclays in Britain have chipped in more than $1 million to the Romney campaign. You'll remember Barclays. They're the ones who were fined recently almost £400 million for attempting to fix the London bank lending rate, and are now the subject of a fraud investigation which might send some of those very same executives to prison. Barclays boss Bob Diamond was forced out over it and forced to take a reduced payout to a mere million or two. But now it emerges that his number two, Jerry Delmissier, is leaving the bank with a £9 million golden handshake. I'm not making this up. Delmissier was one of Barclays' top-paid bankers. In 2010, he was handed £40 million in bonuses when deals were paid out. Delmissier, like Diamond, a US citizen, played a crucial role in the 2008 bank fiddle, but he's still walking with this massive payout. No doubt he directed some of it to Romney over dinner, on top or under the table. You've heard me talk in this spot before about the phone hacking scandal and Rupert Murdoch's News of the World of unblessed memory. I was one of the victims, as were hundreds of others, from celebrities to the phone of murdered schoolgirl Millie Dowler. The former chief executive, Rebecca Brooks, friend of the Prime Minister, has now been charged with conspiracy over the Dowler hacking and other matters, as has former News of the World editor Andy Coulson. Coulson became Prime Minister David Cameron's official spin doctor before he was forced to resign as information about his part in it leaked out. No doubt he's writing his memoirs, which could well include his prison diaries. Syria is a country I know well and love. It's been the strongest, almost the last, remaining Arab opponent of a surrender deal with Israel. I and millions of Arabs supported it for that reason. On Thursday, the fractured Syrian opposition met in Doha to attempt to form a transitional government predicated on the overthrow of the Assad regime and against a background of continuing violence in what amounts to, by anybody's standards, a raging civil war. Russia, which has been pilloried for its stance in the West, is calling for a negotiated solution. Not much wrong with that, but the rebels' backers, like those Friends of Liberty, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, as well as Turkey, say no, clearly scenting victory. Now, my studio guest is Jonathan Steele. He's the highly distinguished and award-winning former foreign editor of The Guardian newspaper and the author of several highly regarded books, including Ghosts of Afghanistan, the central premise of which, if I can paraphrase, is about the folly of foreign intervention. Jonathan, welcome to The Real Deal. We'll get on to Syria, if we may. But let's start with Afghanistan, not just because your book on it is so wonderful, but because it seems to me a kind of deja vu is in danger of occurring in Syria. Tell us, what was the motivation for the invasion, occupation of Afghanistan, and how has that gone?
Well, it was a complete disaster. It should never have been done. They went in to topple the Taliban, and the Taliban, of course, had nothing to do with 9/11. They wanted revenge, but they hit the wrong people. If they were wanting to go after Al-Qaeda, there was no need to occupy Kandahar, Kabul, kick out the Taliban, and do what exactly was going to happen again in Iraq, provoke armed resistance by local people against a foreign invader.
And what do you think the death toll has been in Afghanistan? I have never seen a proper evaluation. It seems like nobody counts the dead in Afghanistan. You got any ballpark
figure?
It's
very hard to tell because, I mean, as you rightly point out, there was a thing called the Iraq body count for Iraq, which was very carefully trying to tabulate every single death of a named person by talking to the families and going through media reports and so on. There's no such thing as the Afghan body count. We just don't know. It's probably 50, 60,000 or so since the invasion in 2001.
And of course, still continuing. I mean, for all the talk amongst Western politicians about withdrawal, withdrawal's still a long way away. The battles are still raging. The Afghan people who have resisted every occupier from Alexander the so-called Great and to George W. Bush, who was far from Alexander the Great, and now beyond into the Obama, now Cameron era. The resistance continues. Is your sense that the resistance is getting stronger?
I think so, yes, and it will. And of course, there's a massive confidence trick being played at the moment because the Western electorates in the US and in Britain are being told that at the end of 2014, combat troops will leave Afghanistan. Well, it's not true because Obama has plans, and Mitt Romney, I think, will continue it as well if he's elected, to keep US troops in Afghanistan after 2014. They'll disguise them with different names. They'll say they're trainers, they'll say they're logistics experts, advisors, whatever. But they'll still be uniformed American troops with guns. And of course, the resistance will continue.
And all of this to keep in power one of the most kleptocratic cliques ever known in international politics. The President Karzai, his family, his brothers, his colleagues, some of whom have been caught red-handed with bags full of tens of millions of dollars passing through foreign airports. I mean, Are we paying not just in the blood of our soldiers, but paying with our treasure for these people?
We're just trying to make corruption safe for this elite. That's all we're trying to do. I mean, it is pathetic, the amount of money that's been spent. And even now, with this alleged drawdown of troops being planned, they're still going to spend $4 billion a year on training or supplying, paying, bribing the Afghan National Army, so-called. So it's going to cost another $40 billion over the next decade.
What's the denouement of this? When the official withdrawal takes place and a reduced number of foreign soldiers are in the country, disguised as other things, will the armed opposition to Karzai not just simply sweep back to power in Kabul and the whole thing will have been for naught?
I think it'll be a civil war. I mean, it has been a civil war for about 37 years, which is, you know, the Soviet Union came in because there was a civil war and it backed one side and thought it could help them win, which it didn't. And the civil war will just revive. And as you point out, the Taliban will continue to fight. And now the Tajiks and the Uzbeks who live in the north and northeast of the country will fight back, I think. And whether the Taliban can capture Kabul again as they did in 1996, I rather doubt. I think they're less strong than they were then. And the country, unfortunately, is split sort of metaphorically and psychologically into ethnic groups. So we're going to see an ethnic civil war, I think.
Now, the Al-Qaeda target, the original Al-Qaeda target, is, of course, no longer in Afghanistan. It's in Syria. But this time, it's working with the Americans. There was a flicker of Al-Qaeda, you'll recall, the US Defense Secretary said, some 6 months ago, maybe 9 months ago, in Syria. That flicker has become a flame. It's quite clear from the modus operandi of the fighters that are combating the Syrian regime. It's quite clear from their rhetoric, it's quite clear from the chatter on their websites and so on, that just about every jihadist of the Al-Qaeda ilk is now taking the road to Damascus and not to convert to democracy, one presumes.
No, they're coming in because it's a Shia regime. The regime of Bashar al-Assad is Alawite, which is a group partly from the Shia religion. And these people are fanatically anti-Shia. They think that they are complete infidels, basically, and we're seeing the same kind of killing they want to continue doing that they did in Iraq 5 or 6 years ago when that was the target.
Is there no sense, you're a very distinguished and experienced foreign correspondent, is there no sense in Washington of the dangers of this? I always make the point about Afghanistan. We'll come back to your book in a minute. These people didn't read Frankenstein to the end. Because once you've created the monster, of course, because it's a monster, it by definition is no longer under your control. And the monster they created to fight the Red Army in Afghanistan became the authors of the disaster, the massacre on 9/11. Is there no sense of trepidation in Washington amongst policymakers in the State Department and so on about the new monster that they're making?
I think there is, which is why people like James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, did go before a congressional committee and become really the first top official in the West to say Al-Qaeda is moving to Syria. Up to then, it had been a secret that nobody dared mention because everybody was saying these people are unarmed freedom fighters, you know, against this vicious regime in Damascus and so on. And when the evidence began to emerge that Al-Qaeda was there, nobody wanted to say anything about it, and Clapper was the first to say that, and I think he's worried. But the point is, as so often, the United States has a divided administration. There are different voices, some more hawkish than others, some more neocon than others. And I think you get people like Hillary Clinton, who are very keen on toppling President Assad because they think he's a tyrant and so on, and they feel he's lost his usefulness to them in the Middle East. And then you've got these people in the national intelligence who are a little bit more worried and so on. And then you've got Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the big allies of the United States, who are pushing really hard, and the US doesn't want to get into an argument with them. And so it's leading from behind, as they did in Libya, but basically supporting it and supplying some not only information, but information gathering equipment, satellite communications, and all the rest of it across the border from Turkey, obviously a NATO state, helping the militants.
And the New York Times this week seemed to indicate that all of that's going to be stepped up. The US spokesman quoted memorably, I think, "We're going for a controlled demolition of the Assad regime, quoted in the New York Times. But of course, controlled demolitions can go wrong. And I'm wondering if in London, for example, Haig, who's never off the airwaves, threatening Syria with somebody else's army in the way that Mussolini used to do, is in the foreign policy establishment here, no worries of a reprise of the Afghan experience?
Well, I think there is some concern, but they don't have the ultimate decision-making power. You know, it's obviously Washington that decides and Britain goes along with whatever Washington does. But I mean, I think the real hypocrisy of it is that they support the Annan plan, they say, which calls for a ceasefire, political transition, democratic solution and dialogue and so on. And instead of that, they are totally one-sided, the West. They're completely anti the government of Syria. They're completely in favour of the rebels, arming them, as I've already mentioned, with the so-called non-lethal equipment, backing the supplies of real lethal equipment by Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And yet they say they support a political solution. It's nonsense.
It is nonsense, and it surprises me because actually the Annan plan gave these people much of what they claim at least to have wanted: a political transition, democratic elections, the end of one-party rule, and so on, all of which I am in favour of in Syria and everywhere, myself, as indeed, of course, are you. However, people like us who oppose the Al-Qaeda insurrection in Syria, the foreign intervention in Syria, are characterized as friends of the Bashar al-Assad regime. And I just find that very, very difficult, not least because actually all of my political life I was against the Assad regime. But I'm even more against foreign intervention in other people's countries because of, in part, the experience that you chart in your book on Afghanistan. Just remind us of the title of the book and what the thesis of it is, because it seems to me applicable also to Syria.
Well, I call it Ghosts of Afghanistan, the Haunted Battleground, because the mistakes that previous foreign invasions have made, invaders have made, particularly the Soviet Union, which I covered, I went three times to Kabul when the Soviets were there, are being followed now and repeated by the United States and by Britain, just failing to understand the culture and the traditions of the country and trying to impose something. Now, the tragedy is there is an issue of modernization. It is a very, very backward country in the sense that women's rights are completely suppressed in large parts, particularly in the rural areas.
Now, as before.
And so whenever you do, very often you get groups of Afghans that come forward and say, this, we cannot go on like this, we have to develop our country, we have to reform it, bring it into the 20th century or now the 21st century. And these people then get demonized by these completely reactionary, feudalistic tribal leaders and religious leaders in the villages and so on. And so they get resistance against them. And the Soviet Union came in to try and help with the modernization program. It didn't work because, of course, that only inflamed the resistance.
It didn't work. It didn't work, Jonathan, but it was the only period in the entire history of Afghanistan when women were free.
They were free.
And we destroyed it.
Actually, it was the Soviet occupation was much more popular than the American occupation because Kabul had no war in it. You know, I used to go around Kabul, as I mentioned, during the Soviet occupation. There was no fear of anything. There were these blast walls and HESCO barriers and danger of suicide bombs. The Soviet diplomats would bring their families, wives and kids. There was a kindergarten in the Soviet embassy, a primary school and so on. Nowadays, all these British diplomats, American diplomats, you know, they're paid hardship money. They don't bring their partners. They can't stay more than a few months at a time. And Kabul is a complete mess. The Soviet period, there was a much larger group of people who supported modernization. Now, of course, they're all in the diaspora. They've been forced abroad because when these Al-Qaeda types came in, or the Mujahideen came in 1992, all this educated group of people had to flee because they were branded as communists.
Mm. Now, the publisher of the book is?
Portobello Books.
Portobello Books. It's a terrific read. I can testify to that. In the last few minutes then, what's going to happen in Syria? How's this going to end?
I think it's going to get far, far worse before it gets better, because I think the political solution is out of the window. The West is pushing war. It's regime change by civil war. That's what they're doing. And if the worst comes to the worst, they may even use NATO intervention, like in Libya, after the November US presidential election. Whoever wins, I think there's a real danger of the Libyan-style NATO intervention.
Even
at that
in defiance
point.
Of if, the Security Council?
Yes, yes. Even if, as long as Assad is still there by November this year, which is still obviously an open question. I mean, the tragedy is that there are people in Syria. In fact, there was a conference this week at the Convent of San Egidio in Rome, which is a well-known mediation center of various civil society groups from Syria who want political solutions, who said no to violence. They said, please, to the Free Syrian Army, put down your guns and negotiate. But their voice is not heard. They're branded as toadies and stooges of the regime, even though they are genuine, independent Democrats who see the danger of civil war.
But the Syrian regime is not weak. It will fight back, and it has powerful friends. I mean, what would the attitude of Russia, for example, be to a NATO war on an allied country after the Security Council has ruled one out?
They would be completely furious, but I don't think they would intervene against it. They would just denounce it. And they would rightly use it around the world to say, look, we keep saying that this is not a unipolar world anymore. It isn't just one country, the United States and its allies, that control the world. There are other centers of power, and that is why we support international law, the United Nations. That's why we won't support a resolution demanding the use of force in Syria. And if the NATO people are foolish enough to go down the path of military intervention, they will only blacken their name even further around the world.
And sharpen the contradiction between the emerging powers, especially China and Russia, and the West, pretending
a
new cold war.
Brazil and India, yes. And all these other countries that don't want any more this unilateral intervention.
The irony, on top of all the ironies, is that they seem to be prepared to accept some continuation of the Ba'athist regime in Damascus, but without Bashar. Well, any sensible person would want Bashar rather than the regime. He's better than the regime.
But I think what they're trying to do is to keep the state structures, and I think that is good, because we don't want de-Ba'athification in Syria on the pattern that it had in Iraq, where it just became revenge against all the sort of apparatus, because they were said to be collaborators with Saddam Hussein. And of course, you know, the structures collapsed. The army collapsed, the police collapsed, civil service collapsed, with the connivance of the colonial administrators put in by the US, Paul Bremer and others. But we don't want the same thing in Syria, even if the Assad family goes. So I think it's very good that there was agreement among the permanent five members of the Security Council in their meeting in Geneva at the end of June on this transition, which you mentioned, democratic elections, end of one-party rule, and no de-Ba'athification.
Well, it's a gloomy perspective, but I fear a terribly realistic one. Jonathan Steele, former foreign editor of The Guardian newspaper in London, author of many highly regarded books. Thanks, Jonathan, for being with us. As Churchill said, jaw, jaw, rather than war, war. Not much sign of jaw, jaw these days. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. But God willing, there'll be more of the same at the same time, in the same place here next week. I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal on Press TV. And you have been a marvellous audience.